Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's awesome.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode number 200. It's a quarter quell. If you're new to Fighting in the War Room, hello. This is actually a pretty good place to start. Our quarter quells are episodes where we each bring a movie instead of doing our usual three-segment show, that we have a four-segment show to talk about. This particular quarter quell, we have gotten recommendations from our listeners for foreign films that can be found on Netflix. So hopefully you've been following us on Fighting in the War Room on Twitter, or FITWR on Twitter. I don't know what the other one is. Don't follow that. And have watched along with us, because we're going to discuss these movies in their entirety. But first, let's hear from the listener who recommended a Korean horror film for Katie Rich.
Hi, this is Matt. I chose Train to Busan in response to a question online asking for a recommendation that fit a couple of criteria, being a scary movie, a foreign film, and also something that was available to stream on Netflix. Train to Busan is a South Korean zombie movie, and maybe I partially chose that because of the Olympics going on. It's just in my consciousness. But I think it's a really solid choice for fitting those criteria, especially for something that's been made in the last couple of years. Like I said, a South Korean zombie movie set on a passenger train that runs from Seoul to Busan. It's really tightly plotted, it's fast-paced, and incorporates a lot of elements of other great zombie films and disaster movies. There's a series of great set pieces that run one after another. It has a lot of that forward momentum, almost mirroring the train that it runs on. More importantly, though, it actually has a story, and it develops a heart and has a positive message overall, which is not something that you see in a lot of horror movies. The movie opens really quickly and efficiently, so by about the 10 to 15 minute mark, we understand our zombies, we're actually on the train with our story in place, characters in place, and zombies already running amok. So from that point on, it's pretty solid action to the end. The story is about a recently divorced father who's now like married to his job, spending all his time at work, neglectful of his young daughter. He kind of inattentively botches her birthday present, misses a recital, and he's trying to promote this very, like, me first, look out for yourself, look out for a number one kind of message to her. And after screwing things up with her birthday, he agrees to take her back to his mother's, which is in Busan. It's kind of reminds you of, like, a Peter Panning in the movie Hook, but instead of, like, Captain Hook and Neverland, he's saving her from a train full of zombies. And instead of being an attorney, he is a hedge fund manager. A bloodsucker, as one of the passengers calls him. One of the best qualities of Train to Busan is the internal logic of its characters. Unlike a lot of horror characters, you know, like stumble into things and you're going, no. These characters actually develop like a really well-reasoned, rational response to a lot of solutions for the problems that they face. And all the situations and set pieces actually derive pretty organically from the script itself. We end up seeing them responding in a really well-reasoned fashion to all the problems, kind of like tactically, but also morally. Without giving anything away, the film kind of ends with a really appropriately bittersweet climax. And it has like a tense, kind of gripping denouement. But it's also really satisfying and appropriate. If you like Train to Busan, there's also an animated prequel made by the same creative team, director, etc. It's called Soul Station, though for the life of me, I can't figure out why they wouldn't call it Soul Train. Would have been awesome. Check out Train to Busan on Netflix. This is Matt. Thanks.
Hello, I'm Katie Rich, the person who was told to watch the zombie movie Train to Busan, because I think, as I've well established on the show, I'm the person who can't really handle horror. So the bloody zombie movie seemed like something that both the listeners and my co-hosts sort of wanted to torture me with, and then also see how it went. And joke's on you guys, because I like Train to Busan, and it was scary, but enjoyably scary. And I think I'm kind of starting to figure out what that means. And I realized maybe halfway through that I shouldn't have been surprised that I enjoyed this movie, because a movie that I just truly love is Shaun of the Dead, which I think I saw before I had really seen any actual zombie movies, which means I didn't get like three quarters
actual
of the
zombie movies.
Yeah, I didn't get like all the references to Dawn of the Dead that were definitely, I mean, I understood the title was referenced to Dawn of the Dead, and that was maybe as far as it went. But what Shaun of the Dead has, Train to Busan is a much more serious zombie movie. As I read about in David Ehrlich's review at IndieWire, which I didn't read until I had seen the movie, so I guess no spoilers. But it's got, you know, it's got elements of social satire in it and kind of class warfare of all these people who are on this train that is being overrun by zombies, and some of them may be thinking that because they're upper classes, they deserve to survive longer. But it's got characters who the movie cares about. And I think it kind of helped me come across a line for horror movies, is that a lot of horror movies kind of revel in torturing you in the suspense of what's going to jump out at you, and then also in the murder of the characters in it. And as a zombie movie, obviously Train to Busan murders a whole bunch of people, but it kind of takes it seriously. And sometimes in mawkish ways, it definitely gets to the end of the movie and is a little over the top with its emotions. But a lot of it is teamwork and showing people kind of learn how to work together. And the satisfaction you get in watching it is kind of puzzle solving more than just waiting for something horrible to jump out at you, even though that happens too. So I think maybe I just need to find more horror movies that are about that are like people overcoming something in a way. It doesn't have to have a happy ending, but just something to root for.
Well, I off podcast asked you, because this is our Corticwell. We get a little personal on the Corticwells, and sure. I want to deep
tell us your deepest fears.
Yeah, I actually kind of want to go there. I want to know what scares you about most horror movies, or like what's the feeling that you experience watching them and why you really refuse to.
Well, it's not really refuse to, like the whole like joyful tension of a horror movie where you're like sitting there and you like don't know what's gonna happen next and you're kind of scared but like gripping the armrest and you're like also laughing at the same time, that feels just like misery to me. Like I don't like sitting there kind of anxiously waiting, and for something like The Babadook, which I know I've talked about plenty, like I looked up the plot of that on Wikipedia so I would have a sense of like where it was going so that I didn't have to like completely panic that something awful was going to happen. And in Train to Busan, when it started, I really didn't know what kind of movie it was, so I see the introduction of a pregnant woman and I'm like, oh my god, there's gonna be a zombie baby in this movie, like something truly horrifying is gonna happen. And then slowly the way that it's working with genre became clear to me, and it's like, no, this is a movie that's more about people. It's not just in there to like gross me out. It's not going to kind of betray my trust in that way. And I feel like a lot of horror movies don't exist to betray your trust and like fuck you up more than you expect it to.
Don't you feel like the first scene sort of tips its hand in the
with the deer
darkly comic tone that the movie is going to take? Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think it's a really clever first scene, but I think, you know, that watching that sequence ends in a close-up shot of the zombie deer staring into the camera.
It's great!
And, yeah, it's great, but it's also a pretty clear indication you can relax just a little bit, because this movie is going to be having some fun with you.
Yeah.
But I wonder if one of the reasons why you were not as scared as you thought you might be was, not only is this movie not as predicated upon jump scares as a lot of horror, a lot of zombie movies are, but it's also like, how scary can something be when you're watching it on Netflix?
It's a good question. I mean, I've watched plenty, like, you know, I watched The Witch at home on iTunes or whatever, and like, it doesn't take much to scare me, but you know, I was definitely like sitting in the room with my husband who was watching the Olympics and like had other stuff going on in the background. But it was more that like, I feel like, When think of something like The Exorcist or like a movie where it's kind of like the ramping horror is just things getting worse and worse and worse, and you get hit some kind of crescendo. And in a zombie movie, it's like that too, but it's more like a disaster movie where you're kind of like awed by the spectacle of how horrible things are getting, more than kind of on tenterhooks about how much worse it's going to make you feel. At least that's how it felt for me.
I think you hit the nail on the head that this is probably, I mean, if you had to put it in one box or the other, that this is more of a disaster movie than it is a horror movie.
And it's fun as a disaster movie.
Yeah.
What'd you guys think of Train to Busan?
Yeah, it just has that. It just has that energy.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I was not surprised to be as emotionally hit by Aloha Oi by the end, but definitely.
You were not surprised, or you were surprised?
I was surprised. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This, in terms of that, was not the song I think that was going to come out of that train movie that I watched, but I do really like, I guess the ways it's both similar and dissimilar to Snowpiercer, the other train sort of action movie that immediately comes to mind. Say, like, when they're fighting the zombie baseball team. But just the idea of having these compartmentalized action scenes and then writing in the way that the zombies are sort of confused in the dark, which doesn't really make sense from a biohazard, like, sense or as any sort of, like, mutated animal sense. But let's
pretend
that.
You're trying to apply, like, real-world biology logic to zombies.
Well, at that point, you're not going to, but that's the great thing about it, is, like, for its second act, it is like a puzzle of action set pieces.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't have to do a lot, because it's so thrilling and well-constructed, to hide the seams that it does have. Like, crazy homeless guy keeps getting in situations where he should have been bit or killed, but he has to swoop in to save somebody randomly later on in the movie. So he survives.
Like, that happens multiple times, where a lot of people, like, have no reason to have survived and stick around until their plot purpose can be served.
Yeah, but it's I think it's a testament to the movie as a action thriller that it has the momentum where you're not noticing that. And I also think that I really appreciate it, I guess, not going overboard with putting certain like weaker people in danger. Like, the same way that you felt initially scared about the inclusion of a pregnant woman, I was like, oh man, and there's like two old people, and like, now they're
separating. And the kid. I mean, the kid's at the center of the whole thing.
Well, I was pretty sure that the kid would at least make it to the climax, and then the movie would decide what kind of movie it wanted to be with what it did with the kid. But, like, I was very impressed that the movie was able to keep a pace and tone where I was never, like, my feelings weren't being exploited because, these weak people were in a situation. It was either social commentary or a kick-ass train action sequence with lots of just punching zombies in the face, which is, like, it's really nice in the age of, I don't know, Walking Dead and, like, over-zombification, for them to not really figure out a way to kill the undead, or if that's even possible. There's not, like, a lot of
headshot time to think
things,
about that.
Or, like, let's find an axe, or, like, they don't have any time to think about that. They're just punching them and throwing them aside and breaking their neck, which really doesn't do anything because they just get back up, like, crazy.
I like how they get up in this
things.
Movie. They kind of like unroll like hedgehogs or something, and they unfurl into zombie mode, which I really enjoyed. But Dave,
yeah.
I want to jump on what you were saying about like the momentum. It's interesting. I don't think this movie has a lot of momentum, which is weird. And it kind of chugs along like a. But I think that it really works well for me because of the characters, and especially. Sang-hwa, played by Ma Dong-seok, who's the professional wrestler, tough guy who's punching his way through and kind of giving our main
who's married to the pregnant woman.
Married to the pregnant woman, so he's meeting a dad. And of course, the main character, the father, who's the fund manager.
That's not a good person to be in a survival
the
movie.
Guy,
the guy married to the pregnant
woman.
Yeah, yeah. you're a red shirt.
That's not good.
But
well
he's also a tough man, so he's going to go out punching at the very least. But, you know, he's a good juxtaposition to the tight, uptight fund manager it's kind of like force majeure. He makes decisions to protect himself and his daughter instead of, you know, at least in force majeure, that dad just wanted to protect his own ass. But here, at least the fund manager wants to protect his daughter too, but he's insisting to his daughter they have to protect each other. And I thought that was really interesting because I was thinking about Katie watching this movie. I was having a meta experience and being like, okay, Katie, you have a How old's your kid? One and a half. I mean,
right.
Would you be looking out for everybody on the train, or would you be looking out for your kid if you were in a situation like this? This is an interesting moral quandary. I think that's what, you know, David's review is cited on Wikipedia for this movie, like, fizzling out, and he can have his say in a second. But I actually really think it's fulfilling to the very end because not so much of the action or the scares, but because of the characters and the decisions they have to make and the kind of moral complications, which I'm not sure I'd necessarily, I don't know what I would do in that position. What would you do, Katie?
Just to talk about the personal aspect of it. I definitely didn't think about, like, would I save myself or try to save other people. Just thought about how stressful it would be to be in a situation. Like, I think, like, the the parenting nightmare I have is very mild, but it's just that like Charlie is in a room that I'm in and I'm asleep and like he's wandering and I'm like, I'm supposed to be in charge of him and I'm not. And this is like such a giant scale version of that where you're supposed to be protecting him from this horrifying thing. But when it got to the end and, you know, the climax of the movie, I think I might agree with you, Patch, is that like it gets hokey, but it works. But all I can think about is this girl just being like completely devastated, like having watched her father die in a zombie attack.
Spoilers.
Well, we said we were going to spoil these movies.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
But like obviously she's going to be scarred for life by having lived through all of this, as will everyone in the world. But it was like really, maybe it's just that the kid actor was really good, but it was like really affecting to me to see her just like sobbing and like begging her father not to go. It got to me in a way that surprised me.
The kid actor is really good and also really well used.
Yeah.
In how I think, you know, she gets you to where you need to be emotionally, but she's also used as a prop a lot of the time. There's that great scene or the great shot in the scene where they dock at the first train station where everything goes haywire and they're trying to get back on the train and he tells her to wait there and then he runs away and she's still standing there, just looking all lost in the world and vulnerable. And it's just really good use of kid.
Yeah.
Which can really be a dangerous thing in a movie.
And
like
it doesn't
this,
put her in danger in a ways that like make you really like, it didn't give me that like sick feeling, like thinking that something truly awful was going to happen to her. Yeah. And it's not manipulative in that way. Like she spends a good chunk of the movie, like hidden safely away in a bathroom where like, you know, like they need to get to her, but she's not like being attacked in the process. So it's it's respectful of your stress level, even though it's really stressful.
Yeah, I don't think the movie's manipulative at all. I think it actually has it's really straightforward about what it wants to be. It is, you know, it's pretty much just like, what if a zombie outbreak, but on a very narrow train? And
but a very well built train
from there.
Like that. The doors are
sure.
Sturdy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it has its fun with that. You know, it has a generally good idea of how long you can be entertained by all the various antics and these narrow corridors and zombies piling over each other and whatnot. Then I don't know. It's it does get a little bit, my eyes sort of glaze over in the second hour of this movie, and it's a long 2 hours. I mean, there's
a lot of them stuck in the same looking compartments, punching their way through the same looking zombies at a certain point.
Yes. And like some of the shots are really memorable and well done. There's a bit where all the baseball players are running down the stairs, and in the span of one shot, you see one of them fall and get eaten, and then another one falls and get eaten, and the third guy is like, and someone comes along and up. I mean, there's a lot of really elegant staging, the kind that you see in Bong Joon-ho films and films like Snowpiercer, in a lot of Korean films in particular, not so much in Hollywood movies. There's just like so much more kinetic thought put into how this movie is.
We don't get mid-budget
horror movies like
this. We don't really. This is like a Cloverfield
movie.
This is a better Cloverfield than the Cloverfield Paradox.
I don't see the connection there. But the budget on this is obviously not that high. The special effects can be really useful. Some of them are really janky. I will save talk for janky special effects for another movie in this episode. But it's interesting. It's the director's first live action film. He's previously done only animated movies, including a feature length animated prequel to this film called Soul Station, which is terrible.
No.
it is truly, truly, truly bad.
Interesting.
So this is
is it
actually,
so bad?
It's just really, I mean, I do not like his animated stuff. I walked out of another one of his animated movies in Toronto once. He makes like really, really sort of dark, grim, social rot dramas with animation, which is always an interesting way of going about it. But the animation is really stuttery and not, I don't know. It's not. There's nothing particularly watchable or engaging about them, and I just wasn't. I have not been into them. And Soul Station is a lot more conventional as a zombie story. It's really flat as a result of that. He doesn't, with the animated tools, I don't know why he wanted to become an animator in the first place or what it is that he was trying to express through his work. And maybe he got there in the stuff that I haven't seen. But so much of what I like about Train to Busan is specific to live action or and like how he throws these bodies, these human bodies around these spaces. I mean, his class consciousness is very evident in his other films as well. But Soul Station is I watched that after Train to Busan. And so I was like, all right, well, I feel like I already got the main event. But I think if I watched Soul Station first, I probably would not have continued.
Well, good thing Train to Busan's one on Netflix, right? It's accessible to the people. Any other thoughts on Train to Busan from you guys?
My last thought is another pointed question for you, Kate.
Yes.
Be honest. So you're trapped in the front of the train with a bunch of people who are not infected. And people come rushing to the door insisting that they're fine and want to come in. Are you, and you have your like kid with you. Are you really going to let people in?
Yeah,
Be honest with yourself.
I mean, here's the thing. It's like, it's unclear how much those people know, like how fast the zombie transformation happens. Because in the movie, like it happens fast. Like you couldn't be bitten and like present yourself as fine. Like it's going to be obvious really quickly. And you don't know if those people know that, and they're just like letting fear take over them.
But the way it's presented in this is that it's kind of like a rich guy being like, no, don't let people in. And
yeah,
it's a class issue. But it's not.
Yeah, no, I think I would be a coward in the back of the train for sure.
You'd be like, lock them up. Lock the door. Hell no.
Yeah. No, I do not count on myself having philanthropic instincts in a zombie apocalypse.
I know. I would be sad too. Like, I don't know. I want to rise to the occasion. To be a good person, but I don't know.
I would be
a good person, Patches.
I'd be quivering.
Yeah,
if
be a better person.
If we get in a mass natural disaster situation, we're like cannon fodder. Like, we're like the
you
upper middle class of like social critics.
Yeah,
like, what use do we have?
No one needs us.
Oh, I think about this. I think about this all the time and how few skills I've had.
Everyone can dig Patches. That's the point.
We are all, I think we all think a lot about the apocalypse these days and what we might be good for in the event that everything goes as poorly as it seems to be going. And I would probably just offer myself up as food.
There's nothing of you to eat.
Value.
What are you talking? You're not even good for that.
I would hold the first door and I'd be like, leave me, I'll hold the door. And people would be like, there are several successive doors. I'm like, no.
It is my job.
So you would try to be a hero.
I'll keep them back. I'll just, die valiantly and die early.
Wow.
Yeah, I would try to find somewhere to hide and wait out the whole thing and let it all blow over without me.
You're like, the closet is mine. Goodbye.
Coward's way out for sure.
See Katie's movie, The Caboose to Busan.
The caboose that decoupled from the main train.
Yeah.
Is hiding somewhere in the mountains.
Liebe Mädchen, or Love Me, is a film which revolves around a young woman in Berlin. Sarah is struggling to figure out what she wants without sacrificing how eccentric she is. Effortlessly funny, she is also very brash, which rubs many the wrong way. Played by Lily Meinhart, her presence sleeps off the screen. Anger, anxiety, depression, humor, and charm are all on display, and it's hard not to identify with her attitude. I've wanted to do so much, but not knowing where to start or how to process the world that puts many rules and boundaries at her every turn. Her self-destructive personality hurts the relationship with everyone in her life, and it could even hurt the relationship with the audience. But the pace of the editing keeps us wanting to see more of Sarah and what she will do next. This is exactly the type of film that I like to see on Netflix, because I wouldn't have seen it otherwise.
Cool. So a big thank you to Matt Malone for suggesting Liebe Mädchen. We've decided that, or Katie has informed us.
Using my high school German.
German schooling. Right. That it depends whether you're saying Liebe Mädchen or Liebe Mädchen. Depends on where in Germany
I'm not exactly
from.
Sure where
I don't
movie
know
takes place. Does it take place in Berlin? I assume it's Berlin.
I want to say it takes place in Berlin. That is one of the many things that I've forgotten about the movie since I watched it in Berlin last week. So this is
a movie you could have liked.
If I'm
watching this movie in this quiet little movie where nothing really happens and there's problems, there's like a broken computer, I'm like, David could like this movie.
A broken computer is what sells you on it.
It'll be a David movie.
In another world, this is the kind of movie that I could like. I had a feeling just from the way that the first scene is directed that it wouldn't necessarily be up my alley. But Leave Amish is essentially a movie about a... what age is she? She's like an old teenager,
like,
or a young 20-something.
Yeah.
She's early 20s.
Yeah, maybe like... No, but I think that we think that she's older than she is. I think that she's probably like late teens, like 19.
Well, Wikipedia
hasn't gone
seems
to college,
to think
but is trying to be a graphic designer or something.
Yeah, I mean, she very much has like a teenage vibe.
She's
to her,
probably
teenage
hovering
face.
1920. That's fine.
Teenage concerns, sure. But it's essentially a movie about a teenage girl who doesn't really know what she's going to be doing with her life and breaks her MacBook. that's essentially the plot of the film.
That's scary.
And you know what I have to say? I could probably not name a more relatable premise. I mean, like, this would be a problem for me. I don't know what to do. I mean, I think that it would be more of an urgent problem for me even than it was for her, because... unlike her,
you know,
we all have jobs that we need to do.
But you also
right?
wouldn't throw
yeah,
it out a window, presumably.
Yes. So she throws it out the window after a bad breakup. Or is it her boyfriend that throws it out the window?
No, she throws it
at him and
she
it
throws
hits
it out,
the window.
Yeah, she
and
throws
looks
it
out
him,
the broken
right.
window goes, right. huh?
And it also right. seems like they maybe slept together once after being friends. Like the length
yes,
of their relationship
that is,
seems
that
pretty
is what
short.
Happened. Right. But I mean, it's, you know, it's all relative.
Sure.
At that stage in your
sure,
life,
sure.
this is a... seismic ordeal, and right, so she has a broken MacBook, and that's difficult for a late teenager in 2014 when this movie was made, who wants to be a graphic designer and is working on her laptop a lot and needs it for all sorts of things. And she is played by Lily Meinhart. Sarah is her name. And have I seen her in anything else? I don't know.
I don't know.
But she goes and she starts it's hard to get a bead on how in this 80-minute movie it's rather subtle how her dynamic with the guy at the it's like the not generic non-Apple approved genius bar who fixes her computer is an older gentleman, a bit of a lonely soul. They form a bond and it melts into something a little bit more romantic. It happens on the slower side. The movie is not framed in romantic comedy terms. It's very much about her sort of wild spirit and the restlessness of that, and how, as our listener Matt Malone so adroitly pointed out, she is alienated from the people in her life and from herself. And then in a way, because she can be a little bit of a noxious presence, from us, the audience, and she is essentially sort of learning how to be the defiant young person that she is, while also navigating between love and pain and trying to do the right thing for herself, but fucking up in the process.
Trying to get that MacBook
there's
fixed.
There's a whole thing. Trying to get her MacBook fixed. There's a whole thing with her dad, who meets this older guy who she's dating. Her dad and her dad's. Your partner, and that doesn't go great.
Well, none of them know they're meeting each other. It was one of her many stunts that she pulls,
right.
where she just kind of springs a parental meeting just for fun.
Yeah. And again, it's like one of those things that you can imagine as an idea that you have in a fleeting moment at that age, and you don't necessarily have the foresight until it's happening to recognize how bad of an idea
mm-hmm.
it's going to be. And then maybe as soon as it starts, you're like, fuck, all right, note for the future. this is not, you know, live and learn. I found this movie. I listened to Matt's voicemail, and I think it was very insightful and spot on. And it was listening to him. I was like, I wish I had seen that movie. I wish this had been that movie for me. Maybe I've aged out of... being amused by this. I don't know how old Matt is, but I do think that if I were younger, if I were around the age of Sarah's character when I saw this for the first time, I'd be a lot more on board, especially with the idea of seeing yourself at that age reflected in somebody who is living an ocean away in different but similar circumstances. And I don't know. I think I would have found something nice about that. But I just found the storytelling sort of erratic. I found her to be believable, but not in an intriguing way. There's like, I think in the mode that the movie's going for, there needed to be a little bit more movie to her. A little bit, something a little bit more artificially cinematic to sell the vibe that the movie's going for. A little bit more of like the Hailee Steinfeld from The Edge of 17 energy. Which the character sort of shares a similar archetype. But I'm all for broken laptop cinema. I think when we are making movies that are relatable for like a new generation,
it's the new, like your cat escaped, script.
Yeah. I think that there are going to need to be a lot of movies that revolve around technology, but also find ways to take technology out of the picture and prevent it from completely overwhelming the story. I think you'll see a lot of movies about broken phones. I've already pointed out in some movies about, you know, 20 something women in particular, that I see this becoming a trope about like the girl with the broken cell phone, even if it's not a plot point. It's just something that movies are going to use as shorthand to define where these characters are in their lives, even though we all sort of have broken cell phones, but it still reads on screen. I didn't really get into the vibe of what this movie is doing.
Something that I was thinking about while watching this movie. Like even the Wikipedia page for Liba Meek references mumblecore, which, I mean, it's kind of an amorphous term coming up with all these, you know, like the Duplasses and Greta Gerwig's early movies. And, you know, who knows where mumblecore begins and ends, really. But we kind of know what films people are talking about when they're talking about mumblecore. And mumblecore was steeped in this kind of like uber realism. You know, maybe there weren't scripts. Maybe they were just shooting off the cuff. And it was all about realism in some level. And this movie is obviously reaching for that level of realism. Obviously, the personality of the main character is different, so the vibe is slightly different. And as you put it, it's kind of manufactured to a point where, even though it's trying to use the filmmaking techniques of mumblecore, the plot is so contrived, or the situations are so manufactured, that I can't really get there. So my question to all of you is, like, what of these ultra-realistic, quote-unquote, mumblecore films feel that way to you? And, like, why do they feel realistic? And maybe I don't even have to limit that to mumblecore. I'm curious about movies where it's felt, like, really realistic to you, and maybe that's because of your own personal experiences, but, like, why does a movie feel realistic? And why does this movie fail?
I think it's because it... it doesn't always have to dovetail with your own experiences for it to register as realistic or give you the impression that it's realistic. But I watch something like Lady Bird, which has so many literary like moments that sort of pick up on the details of what you experience. I mean, you may not have been that particular person in that particular moment, but you have a lightning bolt of recognition, or recognize that situation in a way.
To me, it doesn't feel necessarily realistic.
What's the difference?
I think there's a big difference. I think something that's staged and kind of like bottled up and boiled down from what feels like real life can feel cinematic and theatrical in some level and feel true, but not necessarily like stark realism. You know, the whole Dogma 95 movement was about realism, just like finding a movie, cutting it out of real life and putting it on screen. And some of those movies for me do feel like The Celebration feels extremely realistic to me, even though the situation there is just like impossible to imagine in real life. That feels realistic as opposed to true. Lady Bird to me feels true. Does that make sense?
No, I think I see what you're saying. I was thinking about Kelly Reichardt as my example for movies that feel really realistic.
Yeah.
She has gone for much bigger things. Like, I think Meek's Cut Off is a kind of a bigger movie in a lot of ways for being kind of a giant allegory. But it still has that truth to it. Whereas like Certain Women, like, it just feels like these people are real and living out in the West somewhere.
Or Wendy and Lucy. I was just thinking about that movie.
Yeah, Wendy and Lucy. Like, I haven't seen that one
dog
in ages. But yeah, exactly.
In that situation, it feels so terrifyingly real.
Yeah. No, I think it would be really interesting for someone who maybe didn't love Lady Bird to see Liba Meek, because the way that people talk about the character of...
Who didn't love Lady Bird? You know, where do they live?
Go hunt them down. Because this character does a lot of the same things that Lady Bird does and acts selfishly and kind of acts in ways that are frustrating to the viewer and have the potential to alienate you from the viewer. And what the movie Lady Bird does really carefully is to kind of never alienate you in that way. And I think this movie is not trying to endear you to the character the same way that Lady Bird is, but I think also is a more frustrating frustrating experience for it, because as David was saying, with us all being in our 30s and too old for all these shenanigans, it becomes more frustrating to spend time with her than gaining sympathy. Just as I feel like there's a lot of that I don't necessarily feel like I need to take the time to feel bad for.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just like something that is, I think it's not specific enough. It's not angled enough in the writing to get there. I mean, like, again, going back to the character of Lady Bird, I mean, that is a hyper-specific character, and I think it's because she is so, like, you so believe that she exists off camera, that all the people that she encounters have their own lives off frame. I mean, it's easy to understand sort of the fabric of the reality, but there's something like faux realistic about this movie where I believe that like everything is anti-dramatic and is trying to move away from cliche in a way, but it's also very arch in its way. It's very, I don't know. It's very
arch is a
pose and like the writing
way is a good word.
I don't know. It's just like, there's not that like spark of humanity to it. I mean, maybe like mumblecore, it's, you have to know it when you see it, and this does not register as mumblecore to me, but
I think it's, yeah, it's weird because there was no subtext, considering it was a mumblecore movie, or what we're defining as like something that was trying to be realistic and trying, you know, buck certain traditions, but it wasn't like it was hard to see the romance coming, or the steps of the romance coming, or the steps of the father and the stepmother coming.
It's an uneasy, it's an uneasy collision between the predictability of that, of the story and those arcs, and like the raw vitality they're going for with the characterization.
And I think because of that, about like halfway through, I started feeling like I was watching like an idealized version of what somebody thought the protagonist should be, not necessarily a person who was reacting to the situation that she was in. And I'll echo what everybody else was saying, which is, you know, maybe I'm too old for this shit. And I, back when I was that person, I'd be like, yes, all these decisions make sense. But as somebody who watches reality and then occasionally has to recontextualize that into truth, this seems like a very real thing that didn't necessarily need to be a movie. And by like the act of them shooting it and using montage to put everything in like a line actually robbed anything that I would have found interesting about this of its momentum. So it's like they're packing up and getting to know each other at some point because she tricks him into helping him move. But we'd get a whole bunch of like quick rom-com cuts of this happening instead of them actually getting to know each other, which would be important because she kind of stiffs him with the ex-boyfriend later. And it's like those little decisions that David was describing as anti-dramatic and were probably chosen to be that, but start ringing false in towards the momentum of the actual movie. So it ends up being like a light, I don't know, 80, 90 minutes. And so you go into it thinking like, yeah, this is fine. But then like towards the end, you're like, I feel like I've been watching this girl trying to get this like MacBook fixed in real time. It's so weird.
I felt like it was watching her completely hoodwink this very nice computer tech guy who did not deserve what she put him through.
I don't know. He was a little odd. I mean,
he was a little odd, but like he seemed perfectly nice and like, you know, should have maybe known better than to help her move. But he didn't deserve. And also at the, when it gets to the end of the movie, I mean, maybe we don't want to spoil it, but the choice he makes is stupid. Get out of there.
Get out.
Get out.
Which one's screaming love me in the title, do you think? You think it's the girl, but maybe it was the guy.
Yeah, it's. I think it's the girl, and she's talking to herself.
Whoa.
I will say I did like the dad and the way that, like, I don't think that relationship gets fully fleshed out, but the way that he's, like, kind of hard on her and, like, not as affectionate
kind
as he should be.
Her.
Well, okay, so, like, well, he's, like, he's giving
his
her
first,
a
his first interaction with her is her coming to him and be like, I just need some help. And him being like, get out of my office. I'm not.
Yeah, no,
and
he's
totally J. Paul Getty's her or whatever. Not a cent. Like not a cent.
Not my money.
Get out.
Yeah. But then there's like a scene later where she falls asleep and he's kind of like, you know, looking at her head and talking about parenting, like a familiar thing to me that I do with my very small child. And yeah, I thought that was like a complicated relationship with the way it worked with his new wife, but it doesn't really take shape.
She doesn't even go to the Apple Mac bar. stand in line.
No, like Berlin has to have an Apple store, right?
Not a single scene.
But probably waiting.
I mean, they don't.
Go somewhere cheap.
I know from experience on both sides of that.
You worked there.
That they do not treat physical damage. So,
well, yeah, the guy should have laughed her out of the store when she first showed up with like a completely destroyed computer. But
that was a funny scene. The computer. Does she really think it's gonna get fixed? I mean, it's so depressing.
I would like to see how they got it that fucked up precisely. Like, did they throw it from a specific height to get it ruined?
It's really not that hard to fuck up. You put your mind to it.
Stories from the genius.
I think you can tell from like what we're concentrating on here that this movie may not have worked for us entirely.
No, but Dave, you printed out something from the voicemail that I thought was interesting about.
Yeah. I think what Matt said is that towards the end of his voicemail was like, if this is the kind of movie that if it wasn't on Netflix, I wouldn't have seen. And that's what makes this movie worthy inclusion, I think, for Netflix quail. Because, of course, I don't know anywhere near me that's going to play Liebemick and is certainly not going to do it in a way that makes me go see it. And that's the beauty of, I think, this Netflix foreign experiment. So if it is, it's like I said, super easy watch, doesn't take as much of your time as some other entries this week. Might be what you're looking for in your free spirit. What were you saying? Laptop fixing drama?
Well, it's 80 minutes long. It's the kind of movie that you can watch on Netflix, watch all of before you have even realized that you've committed to watching. Like, it's the opposite of a film that we will be talking about at the end of the show. So I'm glad that it's on Netflix. I think that this whole episode calls attention to the idea that one of Netflix's upsides is that they are becoming a net for a lot of foreign movies that wouldn't be seen over here, and this is one of them.
Hello, Fighting in the War Room friends. I'm Michael Domenico, and I recommended The Way He Looks for Patches. So a few weeks ago, there was a discussion on the podcast about Call Me By Your Name and whether it was groundbreaking. Patches took the view that not every gay film has to be groundbreaking. So with that in mind, I recommended The Way He Looks, which is a coming-of-age movie that tells the story of a teenager, Leonardo, who is blind and lives in Brazil. He begins to develop a relationship with a new student, Gabrielle, which evolves over the course of the film. To me, The Way He Looks is pretty standard. It's a lot less arthouse than a movie like Call Me By Your Name is, and it's more of a typical teen movie. Throughout the course of the film, Leonardo goes through what any teenager goes through, feeling trapped by his overbearing parents, navigating different friendships, and falling in love. The movie reads as any other teen movie would, especially since the movie doesn't linger on Leonardo's disability or sexual orientation. The way the central relationship between Leonardo and Gabrielle plays out feels really organic, in the way that neither of them totally have the language to always communicate what they might be feeling. And I don't know the exact climate in which the characters grow up, because I've never grown up gay in Brazil, but based on a lot of the heteronormative statements adults make, and the teasing Leo and Gabrielle get at school, I'm guessing they, like a lot of other gay people, including myself, just genuinely don't have the vocabulary at that age to label everything, and I love how realistic that is. And it got me wondering what it even means to be a groundbreaking gay movie. Is The Way He Looks groundbreaking because it refuses to make a big deal out of Leonardo's sexual orientation? Is Call Me By Your Name groundbreaking because the characters don't face crises when they're attracted to other men, and in fact have their love affirmed? I'm looking at you, Michael Stuhlbarg monologue that I'm still crying about. Either which way, The Way He Looks is a lovely movie that I hope more people get to experience after listening to this episode. That being said, I don't actually know what the co-host thought about it, so maybe you're about to hear 20 minutes of people not liking it. Regardless, so I hope Patches and the rest of the Fighting in the War Room co-hosts and listeners enjoy The Way He Looks as much as I did, and also I just feel like it's an obligation to point out that as I'm recording this, I'm wearing my Carol and Therese t-shirt, so hopefully the next quarter quell is just something to do with Carol. Or maybe just the next regular episode, you know, who knows, I'm flexible. But thank you for letting me be part of the quarter quell, and I hope everyone enjoys the movie.
All right, thank you, Michael Domenico, for recommending The Way He Looks, which we all got to watch on Netflix. That was a perfect summary. I don't have to expand too much more about this little teenage romance. I thought this was really interesting, especially the way Michael framed it for us, and I guess for me, that we were talking about Call Me By Your Name, and we were talking about, you know, what is groundbreaking? What needs to be groundbreaking? And it kind of really put a lot into context for me, especially with this whole conversation, this ongoing conversation we're having about representation in movies. Like, what does it really mean, and what is it, how does it impact the quality of a movie? Obviously, we kind of go into movies, we have conversations about them, and we talk about if they're good, quote-unquote, or not. And it made me think, too, I think at the end of our Black Panther review, we talked about if Black Panther was important or not, quote-unquote. And there's better ways to have this conversation and, like, what is good. And obviously, if you listen to this podcast a lot, I get hung up about the difference between, like, the best thing versus the favorite thing and how they're basically the same and that there's no sort of objective quality to a movie that would make something the best. The things that you like are the things that you like. And so we can talk about good all day, but I think this might speak to just my philosophy. Here's my new statement. All movies are good. Okay, all movies are good now. And the question is whether or not they are artful, or whether
including all those ones Steve Bannon made.
They could have some goodness. I have to see them. I don't know.
You said all movies are good.
In some level. But some movies can be artful and some not. And some can understand their characters and some cannot. But there's always, they're made with, for some reason. And I don't know. I feel like most movies. I'll take it back.
You just skipped over the whole question you were trying to answer. You're like, well, they're made for some reason, but they're good.
This whole philosophy has been a mistake.
Let me get to my point, which was the way he looks made me think about movies growing up and how, and this might be controversial, but obviously the conversation right now is a lot about, people of color, the representation of people in color, and the representation of different sexualities and genders on screen. And part of the joy of the way he looks is that we get a movie about a teenager who is blind and he's trying to have a gay relationship. And he's a teenager, frankly. Like, that, for me, is what I kind of really connected to, because I think that this movie is a great representation of being a teenager and just how much conflict you have. And when I'm thinking back to my youth growing up, and this might sound crazy as a white cis male who, you know, middle class, whatever, just like, obviously there's a lot of white people on screen and representation of people who look like me is out there. But I honestly feel like there's not a lot of representation in Hollywood movies of anyone in general, because we don't tell stories about real people. And I'm thinking about movies about teenagers for me growing up, and I'm like, you don't get to see the teenage experience in movies very often. It was racking my brain.
I don't know if you're going to compare yourself to a lot of people.
No, I'm not going to. I want to recap where we are.
David, all movies are good, but they're also about nobody.
But hold on here. I'm being honest. And also,
if you feel underrepresented, don't, because no one's represented.
David, you can laugh at this, but I'm trying to communicate something here. I mean, you can scoff and try and undermine it, but what I'm really saying is that the joy of this movie for me was getting to see teenagers act like teenagers. And because, you know, 10 Things I Hate About You is not a movie about real teenagers. It's about, you know, fake sitcom relationships. Or you have American Pie and, like, sex comedies. And teenagers, especially in this moment where we're watching teenagers rise up and being taken seriously after the school shootings and trying to make change in this world and being attacked by the right and being told that they are idiots and that they can't vote, and then why are we listening to these kids talk? I'm talking about representation of teenage experience, and it obviously seems less, or it seems trivial to you compared to some of these bigger conversations we're having about representation. But the joy of the way he looks, no, it's, I mean, you're laughing at me, but what I'm saying is that
teen representation is trivial.
You're laughing at me, but that's what I wanted to ask you guys. Like, is this film? I don't know if the way he looks, it's kind of an artless movie, in my opinion. It's just kind of like shot very simply. The characters aren't that deep. Put it up to Call Me By Your Name. There's really no comparison for me. But this movie is good because it's true to its characters. And it's talking about this character, Leonardo, and being true to his every moment. You know, he's blind. But he's trying to navigate these things, and he wants to get out of this world, and he's feeling his way through it, and he's connecting with people he can't see on an emotional level, and he's just so confused. And the whole teenage experience of this movie feels so true, and it's a rare thing to see in movies, to see teenagers represented fairly. You may all think that this is a crazy, crazy take, but I don't know. Is there something to that?
Go ahead, David.
No, the take is fine. It's the ends are fine. The means were questionable. I think you eventually got to a place where...
Well, you had to make fun of me.
I am. I think most of us are, probably. Because this is a good movie, and it's done very well. I'm not sure if I follow your math.
What doesn't make sense?
I don't think it's worth wasting this entire segment on. I was just a little tripped up over the whole all movies are good thing and nobody is well represented. I understand what you mean.
When
by
I say all movies are good, I'm
with...
saying this movie, to me right now, is not like, it's not Call Me By Your Name. It's not an exceptional picture. It's not when we're talking about groundbreaking movies, if that's an important qualifier. This is not a groundbreaking movie. It's just some movie shot very simply on a low budget. I mean, this movie came out in 2014. It was apparently, it opened the same weekend as Captain America the Winter Soldier. It still did pretty well in theaters. It made, got a bunch of money. But, like, this is not a big movie. It's not an intimate movie, even. It is a movie. But because, and I think about Love, Simon, which is coming out soon, too. Love, Simon is another movie that's, like, kind of succumbing and kind of going nowhere. I don't know. It's not an artful movie, but it's, and I hate calling things important. I think that's a mistake too. It's just a true movie. And I think that's what I'm getting at when I'm saying, like,
I think
it's good.
I think this movie is true to its characters. I think that the character of Leonardo Leo is really well sketched and humane and not pitiable for a blind kid who is not necessarily struggling with his sexuality, but coming into his sexuality. It's a rough spot for anybody to be in, really with any one of those things. And the way they compound him only makes him more human rather than less, as he could be in lesser hands. His relationship with his best friend is, I mean, from literally the first scene, first shot, where they're sitting there by the pool and talking about their degree of laziness, there is a really believable chemistry between them. I love how sweet the guy that he starts crushing on is. There's nothing cruel about. I mean, there are bullies in this movie who are like straight up a-holes, but
very real.
One of them is named Fabio, which is I recognize as a common Brazilian name, but just being named Fabio was pretty satisfying.
I think that there's a lot of times a movie like this will force a misunderstanding or some uncharacteristic cruelty into the love interest, and this movie doesn't do that. It's
the best
very
fair.
She's in a tough spot too.
I'd argue on her behalf.
I think she comes off as well. But I think that like all the details feel right. Their whole bit about Belle and Sebastian and classical
music. That's what led you over.
All checks out. they were off, in the email chain about this episode, somebody was saying they were surprised that I liked the gay movie where they listen to Belle and Sebastian, like, talk about their feelings, but not really, not directly. It's like describing half of my favorite movies. I think that this is a really sweet little movie that could probably mean a lot more to... it worked very well for me. I would imagine that if I saw myself in it directly, that it's would really resonate for me. I don't want to open up a whole can of worms talking about sighted actors playing blind characters. But it's definitely something I thought about watching this, and not judging one way or the other, but I do remember vividly the blowback that Alec Baldwin recently got in that awful movie Blind, which felt less sincere than this one does, and maybe invited more criticism for that. But I think this is a really sweet movie. I'm really glad that somebody chose it. I've been hearing about it for years, and I was glad to finally have the excuse to watch it.
Katie?
So to talk about the best friend maybe as a way into what I found really appealing about this movie. So this girl has been best friends with Leo kind of their entire lives. And this new guy, Gabrielle, comes to the school and she like definitely has a crush on him, as do all of the girls in school, because he's got this, great curly hair and seems very nice and is very nice. And you can see that she is jealous of her friend becoming friends with him. And I don't think she has any hint of a romance developing until late in the movie, as neither do the boys really for a while. But I think that, like, her fit of jealousy is kind kind of like what Patches was saying, the idea of representing real teenagers. Like, that is such a familiar teenage thing for me. The idea that, like, some tiny choice of who you invite to go to the movies or sit within the library suddenly becomes, like, the fulcrum of your relationship and you're not speaking to each other for a week. Like, that felt not ham-fisted and added in by the movie for drama, but just, like, what a teenage relationship would be like. And then there were just a lot of things like that throughout this. Like, they all go on this, like, camping trip where there's alcohol, which none of that is familiar to me from high school. It feels like a
Rio,
I
baby.
Guess so. I guess that's a Brazilian thing. But, you know, it felt like being at a school dance where it's like who walked off with who and who's sitting with who next to the fire. Just all of the social dynamics of these kids who I think are sometimes like bullies to the nth degree in a way that, you know, felt a little over the top, but a lot of ways, you know, like the girl who is trying to like make out with Gabrielle and it's like this, you know, the trash girl.
Wait, can I ask you about
that?
I mean, we're all around the same age and I think have similar memories of high school, but, and I watch these bully characters and I think that they are a bit cartoonish and over the top. And then there's a voice in my head saying that in the time since I've graduated from high school, bullying has become such a problem. And
but
that
I don't think
it
these
seems
bullies are
like
that far off. Like, look, I mean, I had my bullying. I was bullied. I'm more in middle school than high school. But like, what's interesting? I was watching this movie and watching these bullies and think kind of the same thing until these guys starting to like get on them about being gay or his relationships with girls. And it's something I definitely experienced. Like, once if you're an eighth grader being called fag a million times, like, what does that do to your brain? Or like, what does that question about your identity? And
especially
how do you,
if you're actually gay and just kind of figuring out that that's the case.
Yeah, or just figuring it out. Like, when I was in eighth grade, I didn't know what was going on with sexuality, and I'm into girls. That's what I was like into. But then when someone calls you fag enough times, you're just like, yeah, I do like theater a lot, and I'm in chorus. I'm like, what do you want? I don't know. But I'm like, where is my path going?
Wait,
what
are
am
you
I supposed to do? Like,
are you suggesting? I mean,
what were you saying? No,
I'm just.
No, I. It's just a fucking.
I think
that's all. I think. Bullies,
sure.
I think bullies aren't exaggerated because bullies don't. They aren't exaggerated in the context of actual like middle school and high school. That's just how cruel people are, and it doesn't. I don't know. I think we can look back and see now that it wasn't that big or it didn't seem that cartoonish, but I don't know. It just
girl bullying is
yeah,
different.
I don't know. I think
different guys.
But what I'm saying is that like I think that maybe bullying has just been in the conversation for long enough, or I've seen enough movies about high school that now I watch something like this, and even though it doesn't line up with my experience, not because I was so cool, but just because I like, you know, tended to avoid situations where I would
cool.
be bullied that
You're
badly.
Cool.
I spent a lot of time in theater where it was just like a whole safe zone from bullies for the most part. You were bullied in your own way by like not getting parts. That I've learned like, okay, like this, as cartoonish as it may look to me, this actually happens, but I still felt like it was the nature of the bullying in here, not the severity of it, but the tone of it was a little off.
Dave, what do you think of this movie?
If we're being honest, didn't really like it. It's a good movie. It's not for me. I think the missing puzzle piece in Patches' argument earlier actually goes all the way back to the Call Me By Your Name review, which Michael brought up in his voicemail. Which, by the way, Michael, you turned me around in this movie in general because I was just going to say I didn't like it and maybe because it wasn't good. But hearing you talk about it, I'm like, you know what? When Patches was talking about Call You By Your Name the first time, he said, I wish high schoolers could see this movie. But then we had a debate about, you know, like fucking a peach. And this is the kind of movie that you want to exist for middle schoolers and high schoolers. I don't think like this is like the good version of America's 13 Reasons Why. Like, you want to see these relationships that don't have to have a weird turning point like a suicide, or they don't have to have an OA angel or like some sort of thing to talk to the high school or that age experience, or finding yourself sexually or dealing with those relationships like Katie was talking about. I'm happy this movie exists because those people are going to find it, and it's a really good example of that sort of movie done well. I think for me, I'm still looking for groundbreaking stuff because I need a little bit of that jolt. Maybe I've been plugged into... Yeah, I'm old. It's another example of this movie isn't necessarily for me, but I'm so happy it does exist because of what Michael was saying earlier on the voicemail. It's like, this is what representation really is. It's that everybody should have movies that reflect their, you know, high school experience. So I think what Patches was saying,
I guess that's, yeah, that's what I meant by everything is good. I'm not talking about Steve Bannon's movies. I'm really just talking about trying to separate our like critical take from our point of view from the idea that this could be good for a certain audience.
Sure. It's a really good movie. I wish it had tried something visually or maybe been a little bit more aggressive with how it played the plots. You guys are right that the beliefs play weird because at least how I grew up, when I grew up, and even now, I would think just by talking to people, like directly picking on somebody with a disability because they have a disability would immediately raise more flags than I think it does in this movie. But it is great to have those bullies around for like, well, it is great to have those bullies around at like the end of the movie.
It's all there for the final shot of the movie.
Right, which it makes it all worthwhile. So like, I like, this is like, I don't know, this is a fantastic movie for young people. But it's not going for the artistic thing like a Call Me By Your Name, which is trying to make a statement. This is just a movie that is perfectly good at being while it is. And I think the thing that latched me onto it and kept me going, even though I wasn't really liking it, is again, like Call Me By Your Names. It's nice, and Call Me By Your Name, it's nice to watch people
go
portray
swimming.
Characters well. Yeah,
lots of going swimming. I mean, I stayed invested in this movie for like super basic rom-com reasons. I just wanted to see them get together. Like, it's the
it's
same
not a rom-com.
Reason you watched the... I mean, it's not, but
not
like also no you're
comp.
Rooting, but you're there's definitely comedy in there. But you're just rooting for two people to get together, like the same as in You've Got Mail. So I thought it worked well on that level. And, you know, they're like, I wanted those boys to be happy. They deserved happiness.
Really early on, I described to Java, I'm like, this kid who plays the blind kid is adorable. He has such a face that like, I hope nothing bad happens to him because that would be heartbreaking.
Yeah. And the kid who plays Gabrielle is like very handsome in this like teenager way where you don't want to talk too much about it, but he's very handsome.
Yeah. And I was like, man, don't just like fuck the girl and the guy, because I thought that he was going to do that for a while. But it turns out he's like a genuinely good person.
He's just a gentler soul. I also like that there's this like this moment where Gabrielle kisses Leonardo super briefly in kind of this moment of frustration. And he spends the entire rest of the movie being like, wait, why did that happen? Did he kiss me for a reason? And then like this way that you, the audience, is very obvious what happened. But I just remember being a teenager and like misreading flirting signals for months and months and months. And that also
that's
maybe
what this movie's
I just
all
had a socially
about.
Awkward
that's what
teenagerhood. I know that's what's
it's so
great about it.
That's what this movie gets so right. Even like when Giovanna kisses Gabriel later, like she's drunk and they're sitting around. There's so much sitting around talking about like feelings or like how people should act and
or not talking about feelings.
Yeah, or just like being super awkward. Oh my god, this movie gets it so right. It's on point. I think that's why it's so successful. Again, like I don't know if I think it was great because I'm just not there in my life anymore, but it reminded me a lot about high school experience, and I think high schoolers would really love this movie.
I think your argument about Call Me By Your Name not being available, I mean, it will also be on VOD very soon, but this is available to every high schooler with a Netflix account, and I think I'm just imagining myself like trying to seek out indie movies when I was in high school, and I feel like this would have been a big hit with me.
Well, that was The Way He Looks. It's on Netflix, and all movies are good, right?
Yeah, let's keep going with episode 200. We're getting too old for this shit.
Hi, Fighting in the War Room. My name is Erin Fraser, at Erin E. Fraser on Twitter, and I'm thrilled that you chose my suggestion of Bahubali the Beginning for Dave with a 7. When I first heard that you were looking for recommendations for your next quarter quill, I knew immediately that I wanted to suggest some Indian films, as I love Indian cinema. I even host a podcast about it, and I don't think I've heard it discussed on Fitware. Being the show's genre guy, I feel that Bahubali is a natural fit for Dave. Commercially speaking, it is one of the most successful Indian films of all time, and it and its sequel, Bahubali the Conclusion, are the most profitable South Indian films ever made. It has also spawned a larger media franchise, akin to what we see here in the West, with tie-in novels and an animated show for children. But ultimately, I want Dave to see Bahubali because it's the closest I've seen in Indian cinema to the kind of expansive fantasy storytelling and world-building that we see in such Western properties as Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones. I hope that the film sparks Dave's imagination, that he seeks out the sequel, which honestly is better, and that he might even find something worth geeking out over. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Aaron, for that voicemail, and I'm sure you'll be happy to know that Bahubali was fantastic for me, Dave Gonzalez. You really hit the bullseye center of the target here, so I feel like I should give a shout-out to your podcast, Bollywood is for Lovers. You could follow them at BollywoodPod on Twitter. I don't think you mentioned it in your voicemail, and I want to make sure people go and know where to find more of your expertise, because Bahubali is so good in a weird... Okay.
To be clear, Bahubali is not a Bollywood movie. It's a Tollywood movie.
One of the many things we learned after saying publicly the wrong thing, and then someone had to correct us.
Yeah. Yes.
Not all... fighting in the war room, people.
You were in Berlin being educated while we were messing this up on Twitter.
So this is a Indian film that comes in two parts. We watched just Bahubali, the beginning, which I think is just the first 2 hours and 36 minutes, as opposed to the second part, which is 2 hours and 48 minutes. So this is actually the shorter of the two Bahubalis. I believe we all watched the Tamil version.
The proper version.
I watched the Hindi version for a while and then switched.
And then realized it was being dubbed.
I mean, having no knowledge of either language, like, I noticed that it was dubbed, but honestly, like, it doesn't make a huge difference because I'm not picking up on anything.
So
it's the kind of movie that, I mean, the aesthetic makes it look like it was meant to be dubbed.
Yeah,
like, there's no language that it was actually filmed in. That it was.
They're so powerful dubbed. That their voices are disembodied from their movements.
So this was directed by a man named S.S. Rajamouli, and here's his quote on the Wikipedia page for Bahubali when he says, this is his inspiration for making the film. I was about 7 years old when I started reading comics called Amar Chitra Kathra that are published in India. They're not about a superhero, but they encompass all the stories of India, the folklore, the mythology, everything. But most of these stories are about Indian historical figures. I was fascinated by the forts, the battles, the kings. I not only used to read these stories, but I kept telling these stories to my friends in my own way. So this feels like a myth, but this is not actually pure Indian myth. This is a open on a woman saving a baby in a river, praying to the god Shiva, saying this baby will live, and then holding it above the river for an ungodly amount of time as we all suddenly realize what kind of movie this is going to be. Young baby grows up to be the titular Bahubali. He doesn't know it. He's given the name Shiva, like the god, because he has grown up outside of his native lands. He decides he's going to climb the waterfall that is near his village that goes up into the sky, and supposedly that's where he's came from. He's always felt a kinship to it. After helping his stepmom with praying, he begins
his
the climbing
mom.
Sequence. His adopted mom.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like a Hercules type.
Yeah.
He is like a Hercules type. It's very,
well,
very
like,
much
if you start
so.
Getting into what type, like every myth
every
from the Bible to fairy
he's,
tales,
he's a
it's
Hercules
all in this.
Jesus.
He's a
Jack
Hercules
and the Beanstalk,
Jesus.
Moses.
He's also Dwayne the Rock Johnson. No.
All right. So he climbs up the waterfall.
Oh, he's so built. There are so many completely just jack dudes in this movie.
There are like a lot of jack dudes in this movie. We haven't even gotten to the guy who just like straight up punches an ox for his introductory scene. So,
but we need to talk about the animals.
Yeah, we really need to talk about the animals. Anyway, go.
Okay. Climbs up the waterfall, climbing sequence. Sees a vision of a woman he falls in love with. Gets to the top of the waterfall. Finds a king in his kingdom. Has kept a goddess, the living version
princess.
Of a goddess captive.
Oh, is she a goddess too? Unless
she's
just a princess.
I don't know if she's
a
princess goddess.
I was a little confused
goddess.
How she was appearing to him in that dance sequence while he was climbing up the waterfall. But she later appeared. She's the warrior princess of the... Of like the slaves or
well,
I think we're talking about
two groups.
People.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. I'm talking about the person they have chained up who's building a bed of fire. Who's
oh, his
like
mom.
The former queen.
That's his mom.
Yeah, it's like a former queen mom.
Spoiler alert.
But not the woman who we see in the flashback ruling the things. Okay, but point being, this person they have captive has a whole bunch of followers that treat her as if she was a goddess. And this Vision woman ends up being one of their best warriors. Shiva / Bahubali decides to hit on her by secretly tattooing her while she's not paying attention, which eventually
I told my wife that I'm like, this reminds me of how I courted you by swimming underwater and secretly tattooing your hand while you were running.
Being nibbled on by fish. So then he proposes his love.
That's really peak Bahubali. That whole scene.
Bahubali. So,
so good.
He proposes, or he claims his love for her and says that he's come to love her, and that's why he climbed the waterfall.
After a huge fight sequence between the two of them.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm skipping over that because that's great, and I want to talk about it later. But she still wants to free this woman that Bahubali doesn't know is his mother, and he's like, I love you so much that your goals are my goals. I'm going to free this woman. So he heads out on into the kingdom and tries to sneak in, but by his good nature has to save a whole bunch of slaves from being crushed by a giant gold statue, and they see him, and they freak out and start chanting Bahubali, and he's like, yeah, okay, whatever. Proceeds about trying to rescue the woman who's kept in the town square, does, as he's trying to escape, the king and his family chase after him, catch him. They're about to punish the mother, and then Bahubali gets all pissed and with his god power fights them all off. And then the head knight of the king, who's increasingly loyal but like guilt ridden, and we don't really know why. Yeah, Katapa. Sees his face.
Best character.
Cleaned from mud, and is like, you're Bahubali. And we're halfway through the movie as we jump backwards in time.
Hour long flashback. Cut to.
Yes. I don't even know if we're done with the flashback, because the rest of the movie consists of the flashback telling the story of Bahubali's father, who was sort of betrayed by his sort of brother. There's like a kinship way that these two princes are put into battle to figure out which one of them will be king, and supposedly the one that kills the leader of the Blackface tribe, my words, not theirs,
we'll get into that too.
Yeah, we could get into that later. As it will become king, and bad guy king kills him but doesn't have any honor because he's killed some of his own people. And so they declare that Bahubali is going to be king.
Bahubali the Elder. This is where I got
the
confused.
Elder.
And because they're played by the same guy.
They are played by the same guy.
No, I think so, they're the same. I mean, well, I guess this is up for debate, but I assume that he's like a resurrected version of this character we're seeing.
That's why I'm saying, like, Devasena might be like a god woman. We don't really know.
Oh, I thought it was just he was playing
the
his father.
Because what's confusing is that Balaladeva is his brother that they're competing in this war contest. That's the same guy who's still alive in the present day, even though Bahubali has grown up as a child and then is now looking just like Bahubali from the past. And Balaladeva looks the same.
Balaladeva has some gray hairs in the oxen.
This is why we're going to have to watch the sequel later, but
anyway, so after this flashback, we learn about that betrayal I just outlined. We flashback forward to young Bahubali learning about his father for the first time. And he's like, what happened? I would like to meet this great warrior. And then Katapa, who's been like the heart, the blue, the bear of Bahubali, is like, I killed him. And we cut away to this
flaming
background.
The winter soldier in Wakanda. Oh, no.
As Katapa sticks a sword into presumably Bahubali, and then it's like, to be continued next year in Bahubali the Conclusion, and that was the end of our
which you can also watch
movie
on Netflix.
I missed the part in the director's bio about, you know, where he got all these things, when he fucking watched The Lord of the Rings for several years.
He was like, I can make orcs.
I mean, like, that is, and I think we're all probably coming from a place of ignorance, even more so than usual, talking about this movie. And my experience and exposure to Tagalog cinema is minimal, even less than my experience to Bollywood. But it does seem to me like the biggest influence on this movie, at least the biggest one that I could identify, was Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings.
Well, I think Wuxia film probably had an influence.
Wuxia?
Wuxia? Is it Wuxia or Wuxia? I don't know, Wuxia.
It cannot possibly be Wuxia. I don't know what it is.
Why is it a Wuxia?
It's gonna. We're gonna have to like take Eleanor and like reteach her every
is it
word
Wuxia?
That she knows.
This is not how Chinese works.
God damn you all!
But Patches, you're not wrong. I mean, like, this is a great stew of influences. I do see, like, Lord of the Rings, if Weta was working on, like, a $30 budget. I've never seen a film that has such a fascinating collision between things that look great and things that look just incredibly janky. Like, they were made at
but
home.
That's, like, the beauty of it. I feel like this is artier than some piss poor Hollywood blockbusters with bad CGI. I know you have taken CGI to task and have written essays on IndieWire about just like how in years to come it's going to be such a complete failure and we're only going downward with the trend of special effects in America. But like, I found the special effects in this, even though they're worse than modern action movies, to be almost like rear screen projection joyful, that they that they're cartoonish in this Eastern way. You see this a lot in Japanese movies and Chinese movies too, where they're supposed to be a cartoon, like all these CG backdrops. Whenever they could put a green screen behind these people and make and make it look like an illustration, they do. It's like Sin City almost. It's crazy.
Listen, I don't want any of our affection for this movie to feel condescending or pitiable in any way, but reading on the Wikipedia page about how long it took to make the visual effects for this movie does, I mean,
yeah, sure, they spent like 3 years,
like 90% of it visual effects based.
Well, they spent like 3 years working on the waterfall.
2,500 VFX.
I mean, the waterfalls
shots,
are
2 years working
wild.
But I agree with Patches that like the high low. I mean, like, there's a shot where they're running on, like, AstroTurf that like, still has the price tag on it, pretty much. But some of the stuff looks really, really good. And then, you know, they sort of get a get-out-of-jail-free card with a lot of the animal works because they put on the screen in small letters in the lower left-hand corner the letters CGI whenever they use CGI animals because they don't want you to think or
this is a censorship law. They have to do this. Yes.
That they don't want you to think that they're enacting violence on these animals. But trust me, you would never think that these animals were real in the first place. But seeing that somehow gives you permission to buy into the fantasy more than you might otherwise. But there's also, like, you know, while that is all kind of janky, obviously the confidence and the fluidity of the song and dance numbers in particular is so striking and so powerful. And it's, you know, this is a region of cinema where everything has these massive dance numbers. I wish more American movies watching this. I desperately wish Black Panther had like a full-on musical dance number with all the characters.
So
it would have been crazy. I did think a little bit less of like all the incredible work that goes into creating Wakanda when I see this, and I'm like, this is just another fucking Tollywood movie, and they're just crushing it.
Well, no, this is like, the most expensive movie ever made in India.
I know. But it looks, I'm like, wow, there's just so much that we're missing out on. Those songs are so good. One of my friends on Twitter was telling me that she like obsessively watches this movie now, and we'll just like go and run through her mixes of the favorite songs, and like I totally understand why.
But those sequences are beautiful for me,
and like unironically so. They are like genuinely like Vincente Minnelli at his prime.
Yeah, I mean the songs are great, but I just love how they segue to them. That's the real joy to me. That like you can see Bahubali climbing up the waterfall, or no, early on in the movie, his mother or his foster mother is praying to Shiva by like dousing this statue of sorts with water, and she has to keep lugging jugs of water and pouring it over, and he's like, no, I'm done with this, you're never doing this again. And he lifts it up and he carries it over to the waterfall, and he's like, oh look, if I put it under the waterfall, it's always getting water. And everyone's like, oh, you did it, Bahubali. And
you solved Shiva's riddle.
Yeah, you solved it. And then
he turns
to the camera starts like going, dude,
this is victory dance. It's so great.
And then a big musical number, and it's just like, yes, it all makes sense here. The joy of...
Dude, shout out to Prabhas, the actor who plays Bahubali, who is the most, I mean, I'm assuming that he's, like, the most massive star alive in India, but he is, like, the most charismatic.
But he's also a great, like, fighter. I don't know how much of the stunt work he's doing, but I think that the fight scenes in this movie are pretty extraordinary. There's a lot of, like, mano a mano combat in this that's, like, really physical and really well done. I keep thinking about how bad Christopher Nolan is at, like, shooting hand-to-hand combat, and there are widescreen fights in this that are, like, these guys are really muscular and can really kick ass. And dancing
probably
helps.
He is the first South Indian actor to have his wax statue in Madame Tussauds.
Oh, wow.
There's a Bahubali in Tussauds?
Or water on it.
In some of the
somewhere.
I stopped several times and went and found Java and interrupted her what she was doing just to show her little snippets of this movie. Just because they're like, watching the whole thing is what it is, and the story is large and epic and that, but like, just, yeah, David's friend who's going through and like doing the mix of the songs, I could see myself and have jumping into my favorite parts of Bahubali just when I remember them to like see it again, because I feel like that's like the great thing about having this available on streaming, is I could watch the waterfall fight scene where he makes her into her goddess vision of that he had by like squishing berries and using them as lipstick.
And it's slowly like undressing her with like the swords that they are fighting each other with.
Yeah, and then like
so
running
sexist,
his hand through her hair so he could take the bun out. Yeah, it is, but like I kept thinking about the first time I saw it, I'm like, this is like just kicking ass of that Zorro scene. They're like the only other sword fighting undressing scene that I know of. Bahubali's like, I could do that, but with joy.
Yeah, that would not play well in the Western world.
That scene would I kind of like went with that scene as like being the product of another culture and being entertaining in itself. I think the one bullshit thing is that she doesn't get to go on the rescue mission that she's been like assigned for among all of her fellow warriors. Like, she should have at least joined him on that rescue mission.
She disappears from the second half of this movie, but I assume in the next 2 hours and 45 minutes that she mounts a return.
Unless it's all a flashback. We don't even know if it's... We're still
in
the second flashback.
Well, presumably she has a backstory. I mean, I'd hope so. That's the thing. That's the mystery of Bahubali. There are little things around it that like hint that there could be problematic things in the future. But it charms its way through. Like Katie mentioned, we should revisit the fact that everybody's just painted black and that makes them evil at the end.
Speaking of problematic, not everybody, just the bad guys who show up who have like their war plan's been stolen sold to this tribe by a traitor, and that, you know, you hear that they're evil, and then they show up and they are in blackface, that they really do look more like orcs from Lord of the Rings than like human beings. But they're also speaking like pidgin African-ish language that I don't think is a real language. It's bad.
They also kind of suck, though, is the thing. Like, you watch... I don't know if they pay off in the next movie, but you watch 2 hours of the movie at that point, and there are so many characters, there's so much intrigue or convoluted mythology between them all, and then they introduce this, like, random other army to be the big bad in this movie, and you have no investment in them whatsoever.
It's a second movie. I mean, you're supposed to take a break.
No, it's the first movie.
Yeah, no, I know,
but... I'm talking about, like, the context of the first movie, and that
if you're taking the intermission in
a theater... And I would be not just, you know, on tenterhooks for the next movie. I would be like deeply frustrated at how incomplete this one was. Although I do want to give a quick shout out before I turn it over to a guy I know named Laya, who wrote an article for the New York Times about going to the film festival in Pyongyang where they screened this movie. And it's an interesting article, but all I could think about while I was reading it was like how insane it was to watch this movie at home. How insane it must have been to watch this movie surrounded by like North Korean bureaucrats and people who were there for whatever
reason.
People
should follow Laya on Twitter at Lazy Garfield. He's a good follow.
Lazy Garfield.
He's a good follow.
Oh, Bahubali. I'm going to have to watch Bahubali, the conclusion.
Definitely.
And the only reason I haven't yet is because I didn't want it to taint my talking about just Bahubali the beginning. I didn't want to like accidentally give away the conclusion, because I guarantee you once I see the conclusion I will no longer think about these two movies as two separate movies. It will just be the Bahubali experience, much like Lord of the Rings.
Can I ask you kind of like a wrap-up question here, Dave? Look, you're the expert of the mega franchise, the blockbuster movies. We want to hear what you think about every Marvel movie. But like, what do you think that there's something that the American blockbuster can learn from a movie like Bahubali? Is there something that, you know, we're talking about janky special effects, but we're talking about kind of rapturous dance sequences. And maybe, I mean, I was really high on the action of this movie, but like, so what can we take away? Like, what is this movie doing right in its own, maybe it's a cultural thing too, just like it's so unabashedly part of its world already. Like it's such an extension of culture. And even though it's not based on an actual myth, it's so injected by, you know, a lifetime of living and breathing myth. From India, but
yeah, I think,
and that's
no,
why people like Black Panther too.
We are sort of, to a certain extent, we are sort of taking it to heart. But I think what you're zeroing in on is like the unabashed joy of wallowing in your own mythology. Like a lot of times when we go back and we look at the modern mythology of superheroes, we're going for gritty, which is dumb. Or if we go back and we look at like Bible stories, we're going like Passion of the Christ is watching a guy get tortured. That's dumb. But just being like, we're going to have this super charismatic guy lead you through this weird tattooing climbing story until it becomes the war battle for the middle part of our sandwich movie. Like the amount, how arch it is with its overall hero's journey mythology is why I think it needs to be so long to also feel so complete. But the answer why it feels like good is it's just earnestly made with a charismatic lead, much like original Star Wars.
Can I randomly give a shout out to my favorite Bollywood song of all time?
Do it.
It's called Two Cheese Body High Mast Mast from a film that I should know but don't. It's I think maybe the film's called Mora. Well, I don't know. I think it's called Mora. Anyway.
Great cultural understanding.
I have a lot of Bollywood in my iTunes that I really enjoy. I think Inside Man, the Spike Lee movie, got me off this whole jag of listening to Bollywood movies. Yeah, I've seen like four Bollywood movies and I love them all. Especially Sholay, which I think is still the most famous of all Bollywood movies. So it's like saying I've seen like fucking
Star Wars.
I don't know, like one movie. It's Star Wars. But yeah,
that song. But, that Inside Man.
Watching
is an A.R. Rahman song, I believe.
Yeah. Watching Bahubali reminded me of like how much I've been meaning to deepen my familiarity with the stuff. Although I will say that a very prominent critic from India. There's a guy I've seen in and around the film festival circuit for a number of years, reached out to me today to say how much he thinks that this movie is trash. Let me read you his exact tweet, if I can find it.
He's
here.
David,
I mean,
I do
wonder if this feels like listening to people somewhere else, like see Transformers.
I'm
like
sure
Transformers
it does.
3 and be like, oh my god, this is what America's been up to this whole time.
Did you know they could make robots that well?
I'm
I mean,
sure
the robots
it does,
are good.
And I want to throw a bone out to our more informed listeners out there who are like, what the fuck? Like, stay in your lane, asshole.
Well,
the whole spirit of this effort,
I think, was for us to step outside of our lane.
I'm putting words in hypothetical listeners' mouths, but I'm just saying that there is a certain degree of cluelessness that we are inviting.
Yeah, but we're not just praising it completely either. I mean, there are ups and downs of this movie for sure, but there's
things to really
like. I think
we're aware
of
the limits of our knowledge about this and taking it for what we can.
Anyway.
Don't be defensive.
We are clearly not
enjoy what you want.
This movie's a huge hit. We are clearly not the first people to it. Not even anywhere close, even in the Western world. I tweeted last night, I have seen the light, and it is called Bahubali, with a great gif, I might add. And like 600 people were like liked it, and a bunch of people were like, oh, like you're finally discovering it. Oh my god, you're watching this movie. I'm so excited. And then Asim Chabra, who's this critic I referred to earlier, wrote to me, oh god, this is how slowly the world as we know it ends, when those who define good taste in arts fall prey to crass popular culture. David may believe he's seen the light, but if this is the only kind of Indian cinema he will watch, then there's darkness ahead.
Whoa.
My problem with Bahubali is that all the money in the world, plus CGI, which I thought was funny for him to point out because the CGI is not exactly a strong suit in this film, cannot buy you a good, strong narrative, and he is not wrong. But to start with, watch Malayalam.
Maybe we should just put this on the website
uncultured.
Somewhere.
A film called Angamali Diaries. Looking to see where you can find a good subtitle print. I'll recommend more films. Anyway,
great.
I thought he's a guy who is, I am known to have informed strong taste. And so I was, you know, watching the movie this morning and like really in my Bahubali groove as I get on my commute to work. And it kind of put me in my place. And so worth thinking about.
Well, you are the guy who defends Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So this is actually deeply on
to my dying
probably.
Day.
Well, guys, I think it's a great example of what we were looking for, which was a foreign film on Netflix that listeners suggested specifically to us.
Yeah.
Good job, Aaron. You win in my book.
Do we want any like final thoughts on how this experiment worked for all of us? I was really satisfied with how this turned out and like what I learned from watching all of these movies. Because as someone who like gets onto Netflix and winds up either putting on children's programming or 30 Rock reruns, like kind of digging through for all the bemoaning we do of the movies that are on Netflix, there's a lot on there.
I mean, there are a lot of bad movies on Netflix, to be quite honest. And this experiment, I'm not sure this made me think that Netflix is a trove of hidden gems or something. But I think the power of recommendation is what this experiment speaks to.
Yeah.
I love hearing from people about what we should watch and insisting that people do it because we got to get out of our shells.
I think
go ahead, Dan.
It sort of reinforces, I don't know, the social component of loving films. It suggests that we as curators will continue to have jobs, I hope, in some capacity, knock on wood, for as long as Netflix resorts to a thumbs up, thumbs down system that helps nobody. It's cool to have these films shown to us. It made me think that a movie that won Berlin last year and is currently nominated for Best Picture, On Body and Soul, is also on Netflix. Nominated for Best Foreign Language Picture. Like that's on Netflix. There are higher, and it's a movie that I've seen and I like. There are higher quality movies there. They will just not be brought to the surface unless people bring them to your attention. So I am really grateful for our smart listeners for rooting this stuff out.
Yeah, go curation. I heard today that the director of Rec has a movie called Veronica that's just on Netflix now, and nobody told me. And this is how we're going to fix that problem. I've said before, like, one of the great things about film festivals is rolling the dice and that moment where you start a movie and you're plugged in, you're like, this is going to be something. this is a great way to do that without having to necessarily commit large pieces of your life to traveling to those festivals and attending those events, which you should still do, but
yes.
You could get that thrill anywhere with Netflix and foreign films, I think, if you have the old film community at your back, at least people you trust.
Are we making Netflix recommendations to close this out? Because I have one too.
Oh, if you want, yeah.
So one of the films nominated for Best Documentary Short Oscars called Heroine is on Netflix, and it is great. It's like 40 minutes, so even shorter than Liebemisch, and very worth your time.
Heroine with a parenthesis E at the end, right?
Exactly, because it is about women who are working to combat the opioid epidemic.
Whoa, that's almost as clever a title as the way he looks.
It's got layers, man.
Okay. I guess that's Quarter Quill. That seems like a good length. Guys, until we come back to you next week with a normal episode, where can people find more of your work on the internet? Let's start with Matt Patches.
I am Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist. I can now pronounce Washia.
Actually, I looked it up. It seems like there's a lot of different arguments for how to pronounce it. So maybe some.
But none of them are yours.
Some listeners should maybe help.
There could be
us
a
out.
Lot of different arguments, Fuck which y'all. Is why I did not pipe up to confidently say, no, this is how it's said. But I still think with some confidence I could say that Matt's suggestion was wrong.
Hootsia! no. Anyway, we have a website, fightingintheworm.com. You can listen to episodes. You can share. You can give your reactions to this episode and talk about the films that we talked about, or leave us more Netflix recommendations. We're going to be doing more podcasts, so we should probably watch some movies at some point. Fightingintheworm.com.
David.
I'm David. Hi. I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find me on IndieWire, where by the time you hear this, I will hopefully have published a story that I don't know if it's going to work out, about an essay about why we need more violent movies. That's going to go. Trying to figure my way through it. Suspense. I don't know. Check back. We'll see. In the meantime, you can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You find me on Twitter at DA7E, where I will pin my writing to the top there or anything that's notable, like my new electronica band, Wuxia, which I've just stumbled across a name for. And also on the podcast, Storm of Spoilers, this week we're doing Mute and Duncan Jones stuff. It'll be interesting.
Also on Netflix. God. I don't know if anyone wants to recommend it, but it is.
I liked Mute.
Tune in next
maybe
week.
Maybe we'll be talking about that.
We'll talk about that.
I know I say this a lot, but I don't think there's ever been more of an occasion for me to say, you would.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm at VanityFair.com, where on this week's Little Gold Men podcast, we're predicting the Oscars and talking about shorts like Heroin, like recommended in all of the other categories. And then you can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, and all of us on Twitter at FITWR, where thank you again for tweeting at us with your recommendations. And to those of you who left voicemails, that was really fun. Please keep tweeting at us. I guess that's it. There's no lightning round question. We'll just talk to you next week.
And if he stays, I'll wait for him. Pieces of life. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of life. If he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of life. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of life.